3050 UK Wine Show, show number one. G'day, and thanks for listening to the UK Wine Show, the first ever UK wine podcast brought to you by me, Chris Scott, from 3050. We're going to be talking latitudes with attitude for the next 10 minutes. I suppose before we get into the show too much, we might as well talk about our objectives. They're pretty straightforward, actually. What we want to do is produce the best show based on one of the most exciting wine regions in the world, the UK. The UK is actually the largest importer of wine by value in the world, with wines from all over the world coming to the UK. I'm actually a Kiwi, and I grew up in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, you only get New Zealand, maybe a bit of Australian wine there. Calais is any place in France you're going to get any Australian wines. And if you've ever tried buying an American wine in Italy, you're not going to get it. But whereas in England here, we get to get all the wines from all over the world, which gives us a chance to sample some of the best wines on offer. Being a UK wine show, I suppose one of the things we're going to be looking at is a lot about the UK industry, both from the different wines that are available here, which is obviously, as I said earlier, pretty broad, but also we're going to touch on some of the producers. In actual fact, that's what we're going to look at in the first two or three shows, is the UK wine scene from a producer point of view. Next week, we're going to interview Dermot Sugu from Nipa Timber. Nye Timber is one of the leading wine producers in the UK, and really they pioneered sparkling wine production in the UK. The following week, we're going to talk to Owen Elias from Chapel Down. And Owen's an interesting fellow in that Chapel Down not only produce some pretty good sparkling wines, but they've also got a really good consistency across their range on still wines as well. But this week, I thought we'd just start with an introduction and give you a quick overview of the UK wine scene, covering some basics, particularly putting bubbles into wines. When we were talking to Dermot, he used a bit of jargon, so we're going to be trying to explain that now. Just so you know how it all lays out, 3050 is actually a wine tasting business that myself and my wife started about 4 years ago. We run about 400 wine tastings with private and commercial people. So when we decided to put a podcast together, we thought we'd get 3050 to sponsor it. So it's particularly in the first few shows, 3050 is going to be the sponsor of the UK Wine Show. Later on, we'll hopefully move to our own website, etc. But at the moment, it's they're the sponsors, 3050. If you're wondering where the name came from, it sounds a bit of a cool name, but it's actually quite a bit to do with wine. And it sort of explains a bit of our philosophy about wine as well. Wine grows between latitudes 30 and 50 degrees north and south of the equator. So in the northern hemisphere, you're looking at sort of the top of France through to, you know, the top of North Africa. Here in Twickenham, where we make this show, we're actually at 51 degrees, so we're just outside the wine growing region. But luckily, English growers don't really let that hamper them, and they give it a go. As we go through different shows, we'll be interviewing winemakers and covering wines and keep you up to date with news and events occurring in the UK and Europe. The show will on occasion get a bit technical. I'm a bit of a technical type person, so I don't believe in hiding any technicalities, but we'll try and explain it in a way that doesn't really require you to have any other knowledge of wine. So that's our style generally, is to try and take the complex and explain it as simply as possible, and at the same time enhancing your wine appreciation. Next, we're going to be covering English wine and the general production in England and what the issues are. But before we get into that, we just have a short news break with the World Wine headlines read by Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Well, a few things have caught my eye in the news this week. Firstly, the Paris wine tasting that was rerun. So just to give you a bit of background, in 1976 there was a wine tasting of French and Californian wines, and Californian wines were voted superior to their French counterparts. And this tasting really put Californian and New World wines on the map. And this tasting has just been rerun with the exact same wines from the 1970 and 71 vintages. And again, Californian has beaten the French. Wine critics Jancis Robinson and Matthew Jukes were at the tasting that was held in London, while over in Napa, the wines were tasted simultaneously by an equally eminent panel. The tasters were generally impressed by the quality after 30 years in the bottle and found it difficult to tell the French and American wines apart. The next piece of news is that Lanson has launched a World Cup champagne. They're attempting to lure the footy fans away from the lager. It's available worldwide and follows in the footsteps of a special edition Black Label Wimbledon champagne that went on sale last month. And lastly, Ernest and Julio have been removed from the Gallo labels. They've actually decided to change the name from Ernest and Julio Gallo to the Gallo Family Vineyards. They're the second biggest wine company in the world. Most people, well, will all have heard of them. And the move is designed to underline the fact that Gallo is still family owned and family run, but not with Ernest and Julio at the helm. Actually, Julio died in 1993, and Ernest at 97 is no longer actively involved in the business. In fact, it's run by Joe, Ernest's son, who employs 9 family members. And the new name, along with new packaging, is due to be launched in 2008, and that's to celebrate the company's 75th anniversary. And that's it from me this week. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. So why do people produce wine in England? The English weather is a bad of many an international joke. But the island climate is warmed by the Gulf Stream, which means that England can grow vine successfully, even at latitudes 52 degrees north, which is a lot further north than Germany or France, and outside that 30-50 bound that we talked about earlier. In fact, wine has been grown in the UK for well over 1,000 years, but it's always been difficult to ripen grapes this far north of the equator, which is why vineyards have always concentrated in the southeasterly end, such as Kent and Sussex, where relatively early ripening varieties have a chance of producing good grapes and wine. The majority of the wine is Müller Thurgau, Rhinechester, Sauvignon Blanc's quite popular, but new varieties are coming on stream. Bacchus has made some promising inroads. It's a Sauvignon Blanc type wine. Other reds include things like Pinot Noir, Dornfelder, and a fuller Merlot-like variety called Rondo. But it's probably the sparkling wines that England is the strongest asset when competing on the international terms. Nine Timber has proven that it can make great sparkling wine in the UK. It provides good value compared to champagne. It also gives strong returns to the wine growers. Let's try and understand a wee bit about why the UK produces the grapes it does. And it's all to do with sunshine, to be honest. As grapes ripen, they soak up the sunshine. The more grapes that you grow on a plant, the more sunshine that's needed for those grapes to soak up. That means that if you're in a cool part of the world and you have a heavy, heavy crop, you're not really going to get enough sunshine to ripen those grapes up. What that generally means is that producers in the UK tend to have low crops. That is, they don't produce a lot of grapes per plant or per hectare. That, along with some of the issues that it's quite wet in the UK, and wet produces things like mildew and botrytis and all sorts of disease pressures, which are quite easy to control through spraying. But it means you do have to use a lot of sprays, and sprays are costly. So a mixture of cool climate producing low crops and high costs in production and mean that you land up producing grapes that are quite expensive. And in the past, when England's been trying to make still wines, the wines have still been quite light. With the shift to more sparkling wines, you get enough money from the wine itself to produce the grapes at an economical level, and because you're competing against rather high-priced areas such as Champagne, the wine produced can be actually quite stunningly good and make money for the producers, which is really what Nye Timber pioneered when they started production about 20 years ago. And a lot of producers are now climbing on board to this. English producers have been competing with Champagne and producing good quality sparkling wine. The weather's only slightly cooler than Champagne, usually about 1 degree cooler, and the soils are actually quite similar, particularly in the South Downs, where the same rock formation pops under the channel and pops up again in the South Downs. So you get similar climate and very similar soils. So all that's left now is for the winemakers to get enough experience and produce some good sparkling wine, which is what they've been doing. It's good that England's making sparkling wines now. It's sort of coming home for them. In actual fact, sparkling wine was first produced in England before it was even produced in Champagne. What was happening was that you shipped champagne wines, which were still at that stage, into the UK, and there they'd sit in people's cellars. As the temperature warmed up, any yeast that was still in the bottle started to reactivate and start eating the sugar. They'd gobble up all that sugar and convert it to alcohol, producing carbon dioxide, and that carbon dioxide dissolved into the wine. So when the winemaker or the person owning the wine opened up the bottle of wine, they'd get a fizz. That's sort of how champagne's made. All it is a fermentation that occurs in the bottle, and you open the bottle up and there's your fizz. One of the problems with producing sparkling wine this way is that the yeast builds up in the bottle and you land up with a sediment of dead yeast sitting on the bottom of the wine. In the wine trade, that dead yeast is called lees. And it was actually Madame Veuve Clicquot who actually discovered how to get rid of the dead yeast to make the wines a lot cleaner and not so cloudy. What she did was she gradually tipped the wine bottle over, and as she did so, she rotated the bottle, and the yeast slowly worked its way to the neck of the bottle. Then, if you dip the bottle into a cold salt solution, brine, we call it, it freezes the top inch or two of the bottle, which has the dead yeast in it. You open the bottle up, that dead yeast shoots out because it's frozen, and you top the wine up with either more wine, sometimes you put a bit of sugar in there, if you're making a rosé you might top it up with a bit of red wine at that point, and put a cork in it, bottle it up and sell it. The removing of the dead yeast, or they often call disgorging, and rotating the bottles in France, it has a fancy name called riddling. But the main objective is to get rid of that dead yeast or lees, because it clouds the wine. The dead yeast that we got rid of is actually used in winemaking. It if you leave the wine sitting on the dead yeast, it imparts a yeasty, bready, sometimes biscuity aroma into the wine, which is really, really important if you're trying to make a vintage champagne or some of the more expensive champagnes. That pretty much wraps up the show. It's going to be a short one this week, as we're just finding our feet. Next week's show will have Dermot Sugru in it from Nye Timber. But before we finish the show, we'll just give you a wine tip. And the tip this week is letting wines breathe. It's probably the easiest way of improving the value of wine without spending any money. If you open a bottle of wine and let it breathe, what happens is the tannins and acids, they tend to soften wine as it breathes. In terms of how much to let the wine breathe, it's up to you guys, but about 4 hours, if you just open the bottle and lift it on the side, about 4 hours you'll get some effect. If you can't wait 4 hours, and I know when I get home from work I can't wait that long, what I tend to do is just pour it into a big 2-litre jug, pour it back in the bottle, maybe do it twice, and Bob's your uncle, there it is. You want to make sure you get lots of oxygen in there, because what you're doing is getting the wine to oxidise just a wee bit. And that's why wine tastes so much better on the second day. Usually if you've got half a bottle, you put a cork in it and you leave it on the side. The next day it seems to be softer, more rounded, more fun. Well, that's what happens with wine if you just decant it or let it breathe for 4 hours. So hope you enjoy the tip. Do give it a go. You'll definitely notice an improvement in your wine. This has been the UK Wine Show. This is show number 1, and thank you very much for listening.